Thank you for joining us this evening for what will be a very exciting interview with Judith Reichenberg and Robert Ullman. Let me just give a quick introduction for those of you who are not familiar with their work. Judith and Bob are both licensed naturopathic physicians, board certified in homeopathy. They've both been in practice for over 20 years, and they've treated over 4,000, that's quite a large number, 4,000 children with behavioral learning and developmental problems. For those of you who are familiar with their work, they're the authors of a number of different books. Bob and Judith, how many books have you guys written so far?
Eight.
Eight books. Okay, so they're very prolific, and they've written some fantastic best-selling books like Ritalin Free Kids, excellent work, also A Drug-Free Approach to Asperger Syndrome and Autism, Homeopathic Care for Exceptional Kids, and also on top of all the works that they've done in homeopathy, they've written a wonderful book, which I again highly recommend, called, what was the title of it, Mystic?
Mystics, Masters, Saints, and Sages, Stories of Enlightenment.
Yeah, I mean, it's not in the field of homeopathy, but it's really a wonderful compilation of the works of different spiritual teachers from all over the world, and it's a wonderful compendium of this type of information. So they're prolific authors in the field of homeopathy. They have diverse interests. They practice presently at the Northwestern Center for Homeopathic Medicine in Edmonds, Washington. They treat patients from all over the United States and beyond in person and via telephone consultations and video teleconferencing. For those of you who want to find out more information about any of their books or the seminars or conferences that they offer, you can go to their website, which is www.drugfreeasperger.com. Let me spell that out for you. It's www.drug, D-R-U-G, then the word free, F-R-E-E, then the word Asperger, A-S-P-E-R-G-E-R.com. And if you want to call them directly, you can reach them at their office number at 425-774-5599. That's 425-774-5599. Bob and Judith, thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your busy schedules. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kim.
So I thought I would start by asking you a little bit about your new book, Drug-Free Approach to Asperger Syndrome and Autism. And you mentioned in that book that homeopathy is particularly suited to treat these types of children. Can you tell us a little bit why you feel this is the case?
Well, homeopathy, as we all know, treats the whole person. And in Asperger syndrome, there's a particular particular set of characteristics that come with children with Asperger's, like they have difficulty with social cues, particularly. They often appear to their peers as a little on the weird side, difficulty connecting with people. They often have very strong special interests that they love to talk all about, like everything you'd never wanted to know about trains and or fighter planes or tornadoes.
Or dinosaurs or fans or cars or coins or you name it.
Right. And although they speak at the normal age, which is uncharacteristic for some of the other kids on the autism spectrum, they often have a kind of stilted or pedantic speech.
So that's one of the things that makes them so apropos for homeopathic treatment, because they're so unusual.
Mm.
And so not only that, but they love to talk about their special interests. And a homeopath is always trying to find out what's kind of quirky or unique about a person or a child. They also they're very picky about what they eat. And so, as we all know, homeopathic medicines taste great.
Mm.
And so it's very easy. These parents are trying to disguise all kinds of supplements and powders in their food, and their foods are often limited because they're on gluten-free, casein-free diets. And so homeopathic medicines taste great. They don't need to be disguised at all. And, I mean, some of these kids, you wouldn't believe how excited they are to find anybody who's willing to listen to them talk.
Very interesting.
And the parents are also really, really concerned about not giving these kids anything toxic.
Mm.
You know, some of the kids have been vaccine damaged, and so the parents are very wary of, you know, of anything that can cause side effects. And I guess one other thing I could say, too, is that these parents are often hauling their kids around to umpteen therapies and appointments and special kinds of treatments, and they may have other kids in the family, too. And so to not have to have frequent appointments and even maybe to be able to do it by phone sometimes, it's really a boon to the moms.
Hmm.
And one of the most important things is that the more unusual the child, the easier it is to help them with homeopathy.
Hmm.
And these kids are often quite unusual.
Hmm. Very interesting. For the benefit of people who may not be familiar with Asperger, could you just maybe differentiate how Asperger is different from autism? And also, are you finding just in general that you're getting better results with specifically children who've been diagnosed with Asperger syndrome?
Well, we certainly get better results as compared to other kids on the autism spectrum, because they're more verbal.
Mm.
And you can get an easier window into how their mind works and what their inner state is like.
Mm.
Whereas with a child who's nonverbal, you only have observed behaviors.
Sure, sure.
Sort of like treating babies versus treating kids who are, you know, in a fairly highly verbal state.
Mm.
Although I'd like to say one other thing about that before you talk about the difference between autism and Asperger's. We just got back from L.A. and we attended a great seminar with Sunil Anand, who is one of our teachers from Bombay. And he really emphasized going with the energy of the child, and so and finding a remedy based on that energy. And so even with a nonverbal child, that energy can be available.
Mm.
So, and that can often just be the key to the case. So, Bob, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay. So one of the main characteristics of children with Asperger syndrome is that they're very blind socially, and they often miss social cues. They don't get facial expressions. They're not very good at understanding other people's motivations. And so, for instance, someone might use a slang term, and they would totally not get it. They would just not understand what it meant. So, because their communication is very literal and almost concrete in that, and an interesting thing about that is that in many cases they have a hard time not telling the truth, and or even understanding why anybody would not tell the truth.
Mm.
And often have a lot of trouble with communication, and one of the biggest things is that their conversations are often very one-sided, and they may try to dominate the conversation and keep it very fact-based, like all the things they know about dinosaurs. And it comes off sometimes as though they were giving a lecture.
Hmm.
So how would you say that's different from autism?
Well, in autism, children may be also fixated on certain things, but they're not nearly that verbal, and usually. And that's one of the main things that characterizes what you might call the lower functioning end of the autism spectrum, is that sometimes children aren't verbal at all or very minimally verbal, or they may just pick up words or phrases and parrot them back in what's called echolalia.
Hmm. Very interesting. Now, I know when you're talking about autism specifically, there's quite a wide range.
That's right.
Of manifestation. Are you finding that those that are higher functioning autistically diagnosed kids, are those easier to treat? What is your experience relative to the different levels or the spectrum that we find in autism?
Well, I think it's definitely easier to treat the kids with Asperger syndrome. For one thing, as Bob said, they're verbal, and so they
right.
can really tell you what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they're excited about. With the kids who are nonverbal, you're relying on observation, and you're relying on what the parents have to say. Now, some of these parents are I would say the best informed, the most motivated, and the most desperate, really, parents of any parents we've met. We used to say that when we started treating ADD kids, but these parents, they are absolutely determined to find what will help their children, and they've read that the kids whose parents are the ones that are out there seeking all the different kinds of treatment have a much greater chance of being helped. Mm. And so I would say, you know, even some of the parents are just incredibly good observants, but, you know, it's not the same as really having a child being able to express himself or herself.
Sure.
So, and we've just treated more Asperger kids. So we definitely have some good cases of kids lower in the spectrum. I mean, this week I've had a couple of them. And, you know, I think part of it, just speaking for me, I have really high standards as far as what I expect with homeopathy in my patients. And I generally am used to having at least a 70% improvement.
Mm.
And so it's hard for me sometimes to be satisfied with less. I had a follow-up today with probably the most intense patient I've ever seen in my practice, which says a lot because I've been in a practice for a long time. And it's a kid, his mom flew him out the first time, and he's 17, and he's autistic, and he has the maturity, I would say, probably of a 3-year-old. And he was wild. I mean, he was going into our refrigerator and getting stuff. He was getting up. His mother had to keep pulling him back. I mean, he was one of the most extreme kids I've ever met, and would do things like flick urine at people and run around naked. And so I prescribed hyoscyamus.
I was about to say.
Right. And, you know, and the mom was really happy because she said he's 50% better.
Mm.
But, you know, I wasn't satisfied.
Mm.
So I was looking for a better remedy, and I tried Belladonna, and I talked to her today, and she said he really did better on the hyoscyamus. And I just, you know, I mean, I have to be realistic about this.
Mm.
This kid really has problems, and 50% is probably a miracle. And I just asked her, was it worth it for you to fly him out? Because I, you know, and she said, definitely, absolutely. And so it's, and so she's thrilled, really, at how he's doing. So, you know, and he's way down on the spectrum.
So I think that one of the lessons of that is that when you're working with developmental issues, progress is not always an overnight miracle.
Sure.
But you want to see substantial progress from the remedy that gives you at least a very clear trend that it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you see that, it's worth the wait, and giving doses when they're needed over a period of time, like a year, and you will, at the end of that year, see, you know, quite a leap forward for that child.
We had a bit of this discussion at Sunil's seminar, and someone was saying, because we were saying, should we take some of these cases? And a very experienced homeopath was just saying, it can make a world of difference, even if these kids who are really developmentally delayed, even if they just learn a few more words, for example, the parents, it just makes a huge difference, or if they even develop eye contact.
Mm.
So it was, I think we really need to remember that.
Yeah, I think those are very important points. So let me ask you this. When you do see improvement in cases, obviously not everything is going to go away overnight. What areas in particular do you see the symptoms changing first? Like, what is it, mostly in the mental realms, the emotional, physical symptoms? What are you seeing most quickly responding to homeopathic treatment?
One of the things that I've seen really clearly is sensory issues,
mm-hmm.
where kids are oversensitive to everything. As we know, sometimes that indicates plant remedies, but not always. But nevertheless, a lot of the tantruming that you see in autistic kids comes from them not being able to handle the inputs that they're getting. And so oft times when the remedy works, you'll see a pretty strong reduction in general tantruming and upset behavior and sensitivity to noise and to light. And sometimes those sensitivities will actually lead toward the remedy. like in the case of the remedy Theridian, which has a many spider-like characteristics that you might see, say, in a tarantula case, but a very, very, very strong sensitivity to noise, and particularly shrill noise.
Sure.
I think moods and angry outbursts
definitely
very quickly will improve quite a bit.
And of course, the parents of the patients are very happy about this, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Very happy.
Yeah.
And physical problems, physical symptoms right. that the child might have often improve quite quickly.
And then, you know, a little bit later, or perhaps not as dramatically, but definitely, you start getting language gains, where the children start putting, you know, if they're nonverbal, they start at least making sounds toward words, much like babies do. And then gradually they start putting sentences together. And some of them, you know, return to actually talking.
One of the most amazing kinds of changes that parents see is that their kids are no longer as isolated socially, and they're wanting to be around their peers, and that they have eye contact. I mean, eye contact alone can make a huge difference. And not only that, but that change in that real pedantic speech. I mean, I have one kid. I've been treating him for several years, and it almost brings me to tears every time I see him, because I remember when he first came in, he was so stilted and so formal in his speech, and he just talks like a regular kid. And every time I just, you know, kind of marvel at the mom, she almost starts crying too. I mean, it's amazing.
Fantastic.
And there are lots of other things that can change too, but I think those are the ones that first come to mind.
Fantastic.
I mean, one thing is that they also take an interest in other kids, you know, which is something maybe they were only doing parallel play, and then they start approaching other children, or at least allowing other children to approach them to offer play.
Well, not only as far as interest, I did a follow-up yesterday, and this was a kid who was really an interesting child, just a very conscientious kind of child who was very concerned about coins. His whole thing was collecting coins. And so I gave him Orem, not just because of that, but, you know, Orem was gold. And he's done much better on the remedy. This is just his first follow-up that I had. And the mom said, now he is interested in all kinds of things other than coins. And he's interested in coins just like somebody would have a hobby, but not like a grand passion, an overriding interest, which I thought was really interesting.
Very interesting. You know, I think it's very nice for people to hear this, because sometimes we have unrealistic expectations when we give remedies. And, I mean, you can see, as you're describing here, that you can give a remedy and see some, you know, profound changes, whereas other things won't necessarily change. And, you know, maybe they'll take longer to change. I think this is very important a point that you guys are making. And I'm sure that I understand your high expectations on yourself, Judith, but I think it's wonderful that you're doing work where, you know, people's moods improve and the parents can see it and notice the differences, and I'm sure the teachers of these students.
They definitely notice the change.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I know that, you know, different types of patient groups have different types of challenges and problems associated with them, and I'm sure that, you know, that's certainly the case with, you know, kids with Asperger's syndrome or the full spectrum of different types of autistic behavior. I'm curious if you could maybe share a little bit about that. What have you seen as being some of the challenges or difficulties with working with this type of patient?
Well, maybe we can go back and forth on this. I mean, to me, the biggest challenge is the kids who are just profoundly damaged. You know, I've seen some kids that neurologically they're just, my gosh, you know, they're having incredible seizures, and they don't talk, and they can barely hold up their heads. And so I'd say that severity of disturbance for me would be not the number one challenge.
Mm-hmm.
How about you? What would you say?
Well, the kids who can talk but won't.
Oh, yeah. That's you kind of want to wring their necks. Well, another challenge on the flip side of these parents being so highly motivated is they're trying everything, and it's hard for them not to try it all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, You know, even though at the very beginning we say, please don't try, don't add something right after we've given a remedy or a new remedy.
Mm.
We're getting emails and it's like, well, can I try the chelation now? Or can I do this and can I do that? And I mean, we're much looser than we are, I would say, with other populations. We just expect these parents to be doing a lot of things.
Mm.
We just ask that the timing of it doesn't completely confuse us as far as the effects of the remedy.
Right, and in some of those cases, we'll use PLUST or LM remedies that are harder to antidote or interfere with so that we can at least, at the end of the day, be able to tell that something happened with the remedy.
Well, that they can tell, too.
And they can tell, too.
So I'm curious, are you mostly using LMs in this population group? Or
No,
not always. It
just
depends
on
what might interfere. If there's if it's a very clear case with no interfering factors and the child hasn't been medicated yet or isn't getting 8 million supplements, we're likely to go with our old single-dose approach.
Well, I'd say we're pretty flexible because we use high-potency single doses and we use LMs, but we also, I don't even know that we've talked about this much with other people, but we also use high-potencies plus. In other words, it's not unusual for us to give a 200C once a week.
And you'll put that in liquid and then plus it?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, like Kahneman did in the fifth edition.
Right, split dose method.
And
right.
It's not because anybody taught us to do this, but it's just, you know, we have kids who are so intense that a 200C might work great, but it just doesn't last, and the parents are asking, can we give it more often? And so the idea of that it's so dangerous to give it like this, it's not true, you know, and we're always looking for any negative reactions, whether it's LM or whatever it is, and so as long as you stay on top of it, we're not worried anymore about treating like that.
Well, you know, I can say I found what you just communicated to be really the truth, and as long as you do change that potency, as it says in Aphorism 247,
right.
I think it's totally fine to repeat remedies on a more regular basis. At least in my own experience, I found that not to be problematic. I've only found it to be problematic when you don't change the potency, when you don't plus it.
Uh-huh.
So, I think it's a great idea, you know.
Yeah.
And it can certainly speed up the curative process for sure.
You know, it's funny. I think one time when I really felt, I kind of learned that a funny way because I had this patient and I gave her a hawk. She was a really clear case. It was my first case of red-tailed hawk. And there was a mistake. And by accident, instead of being sent 1M, just in a dry dose, she was sent, by our office, she was sent 1M plus.
Mm.
And at the follow-up, it was one of the best cures I've ever seen.
Mm.
I mean, everything was better.
Interesting.
And I went, whoa.
And she took it daily? Or
She was taking 1M plus daily.
Right. And that's what I found, is that you can give high potencies like that without aggravation or problem, usually. And if there is aggravation, I just have them stop the remedy until the symptoms calm down and then begin it again. And if they're really much better after stopping it, then they may be able to only take it rarely.
Right. Well, with this 1M hawk, you know, after that I was kind of really, you know, trying to contain my shock, basically, because I wasn't clear that you could really do that. And then I just told her, well, why don't you take it as needed since it's working so well? And the frequency just went way down.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So I know you guys have worked with, you know, an immense number of children, 4,000 plus children. It's, you know, it's quite a bit of clinical experience.
Well, over time, you know.
Yeah.
Well, of course.
Yeah,
I know
it
was last Thursday you did this, but.
Well, it was a long day.
Yeah. You only got to 3,800 on Thursday.
No, that was just last month.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. No,
now you know why we need to
take
periods of time off and go to South America, right?
No, I mean, we understand this is decades and decades of experience.
Right.
And I'm sure that with, you know, because this is a lot more experience than most of us have had treating this population group, I'm sure that you've discovered some wonderful tips for helping these children. I thought maybe you could share a little bit about what your experience has been and what you've found to be most useful and, you know, really works best with this group.
You know, one of the things is that We've learned that everything in nature is up for grabs in terms of what remedies to give. So even though there may be remedies we might use more often in this group, like China or carcinosin or tarantula or, you know, usual behavior kinds of remedies, we find that you have to be open to the fact that the child may need some very unusual thing that you didn't even think was a remedy or hadn't even been proved.
Sure.
Well, and so that's the one side of it, the open-mindedness. And the other side of it is how you figure out how to give something like that. And so I think it's the two things that I would say are being willing to go with the energy of the case and mm-hmm. the energy of the child, and just not being prejudiced, really having no idea when you walk into a room, you know, or when we do it by phone or whatever, not having a clue what that child is going to need, but not having to, out of insecurity or whatever, not having to pigeonhole them into something that you know, into something you've given before.
And as much as possible, we really look for the source of the medicine to speak in some way through the child or the parent in a way that really clues us in to what part of nature the remedy for that child need it comes from.
It was, this was a kid with ADD, not a kid with AS or ASD, but I was just, I was just taking a break. And in any case, I just saw this child recently, and the child was very lively. It was an ADD case, but there was very little to go. It was a very good informing mother, but there really wasn't very much to go in the case, except that she liked to be the center of attention. She was a little jealous, and she was active. And so I was just watching her, and she started taking these little feathers out of this collar of this coat that she was wearing, and she would just take the feather, and she would just blow it. And she had already told me that she was really afraid of insects, except for caterpillars and there was one other one. I can't remember. Maybe it was Daddy Longlegs. But caterpillars and something. And so,
I didn't think there was anybody out there who wasn't scared of Daddy Longlegs.
It was caterpillars and roly-polies. That's what she wasn't afraid of. And so she kept blowing. She gets bored easily, and she was bored with the interview, I think, even though I was trying to ask her what she liked. And she kept blowing these feathers, and she would just watch them fly, and then ultimately, you know, it evolved. She started telling me about butterflies, and of course, you don't just give a kid butterfly because they like butterflies. But what she had described about herself and what her grandmother had described about her, had a direct connection with what she was describing about butterflies.
Mm. Interesting.
And so, you know, I could, with a fair amount of confidence, give this kid butterfly. Well, it also helped that butterfly had been proved. And I went to the proving, and she had been neglected by her mom, and that was in the proving. And so, in that case, there were a number of confirmatories from the proving.
You guys know who did the proving of butterfly?
Nancy Herrick, I think.
Oh, it was Nancy Herrick?
Nancy does include it in her book. I'm not sure whether there was another proving of butterfly or not as well. I can't remember whether there was one or two, but certainly Nancy did a proving of butterfly.
Interesting. So I know that with this group of patients that oftentimes they're receiving other types of therapeutic interventions. And so I was curious if you found, can you still use homeopathy in these situations? And if so, under what circumstances? And do you find any challenges using homeopathy when these kids are, you know, getting other types of therapies? Just what is your experience with all of this?
Well, it's basically the same thing as any time people are getting other therapies. The therapies themselves may have side effects. They may obscure the symptoms of the case. And so the object is to be able to really understand what the symptoms of the case are without the interference of whatever it is. And so we often ask, what were they like before they ever took Ritalin, or what were they like before they ever were put on the GFCF diet? Because those therapies will change things.
Sure.
And so if you can find out what the pure state was like, and if not, the best you can do is to go with what you have. And if the child's on Ritalin and they're complaining of appetite loss, well, that's a side effect of Ritalin, and you know that, or insomnia, you know. And so you just try to filter those things out and go for what's left. And to try to understand the state of the child as much as possible without whatever interfering factor it might be.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's fine. It's just the best you can do is to do that.
Yeah. Is your preferred course of action then to just start prescribing and not change the medication?
We're not licensed, you know, to prescribe those medications, so we're not licensed to take them off either.
Okay. Because I know, like, for example, naturopathic doctors in some states are licensed to work with medication, like in Arizona, for example, but that's not the case in Washington.
Well, not psychiatric medications. In other words, we have prescriptive authority in Washington, but I don't think any naturopaths anywhere have, you know, can prescribe psychiatric medications. And so... So therefore, we're not looking to, we're not on the bandwagon that they can't take any medications at all.
Right.
We just want to help these kids. And you have to be realistic. A number of these kids are able to get off their medications, and some of them, like some of the Risperdal, et cetera, can cause huge weight gains. There are kids who have gained 40 pounds on these medications. But our goal is, you know, is to help the kids.
Sure.
Regardless.
So ultimately, once they start to improve, how will you deal with the medication?
Well, when they start to improve, you know, we just say you might, you know, talk to your, talk to the prescribing physician, and you know, just tell them how much better he's doing, and then they're often able to just gradually taper off.
Right.
Although sometimes the prescribing physician says, "Good, the medicine's working."
Right. Well, attribution isn't. A long suit of homeopathy, I would say.
Yeah.
You get these little tiny pellets and you give them far apart. And so,
right.
You know, oftentimes homeopathy doesn't get credit for the improvement.
Right.
Actually, you get better compliance sometimes when you are giving LMs or plus remedies because at least the person is taking it every day or.
Yeah, I hear that.
Times
sure.
a week.
For
right.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
So I know one of the things that people have difficulty with this particular group of patients is the fact that they're, or at least many of them, are not verbal.
Right.
And so they don't know, like, well, what, you know, how do you, what information do you use to prescribe the remedy on? So what do you find, how do you find that you work with this group who are essentially nonverbal?
Well, you have to have a parent who's a good observer.
Mm-hmm.
Even a great observer is
mm-hmm.
better. And they really knows their child. You know, the parent who goes to work all day and never sees their child is, you know, not a very good informant.
Well, that doesn't happen much with the autistic kid.
No, it doesn't, actually, because there's usually at least one parent who has to stay home and see the child. So, so we're looking for any kind of information that's characteristic and particularly that's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you have to filter out some of the common symptoms of autism, like echolalia or stimming, as the thing that's unusual. It might be unusual for a neurotypical kid, but it's not unusual for a child on the autism spectrum. But you're looking for something. Maybe it's a food craving. Maybe it's a dream, if they're verbal enough to say dreams. Or it's just a pattern of behavior that they're always lining things up, although that's sort of a common symptom as well. So we look for both the common symptoms, but more whatever doesn't fit the pattern of what's true of all autistic children and what may be the most specific thing that we can find about that child that will key us into the idea of a remedy.
So what individualizes this particular case from any other...
Exactly.
Great. Judith, did you want to comment on that at all, or do you want me to...
No, it's okay.
Okay, all right, good. So I know that you guys, you've studied a lot with people like Rajan Sankaran and Divya Chabra and, you know, Sunal and Anin, the Bombay group in general.
Right.
And I know that, you know, there's quite a bit of focus there on the use of kingdoms, both at the largest level, mineral, plant, and animal.
Right.
And then also, I don't know if you use the fungi, if you consider that a kingdom as well. But then I know you also use family or taxonomical groupings in your selection of the remedy. And I personally have not been trained that way. I was kind of trained in a more conservative kind of Hahnemanian manner, and I know that this use of kingdoms is becoming quite popular in the community. Could you share a little bit about what this is all about and how you actually use it in your practice?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I'm giving a presentation in August at the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians Conference. And, I mean, that's to naturopaths, some of whom may not be practicing a lot of homeopathy. And it's called Speaking from Source. And I'm going to give excerpts from various cases of how patients tell us what they need. And I was walking on the beach today with my dogs, and I was just thinking how I would start the presentation. And I was thinking that I would say, now this is going to be really anathema or something to you Hahnemanian prescribers out there. So, and in the naturopathic community, there's been a lot of controversy between the quote-unquote Hahnemanians and whatever we call ourselves, the, you know, Mercurians or whatever you want to call us.
Socceranians.
Whatever it is, yeah.
But
yeah.
To me, you know, the value of the kingdoms, and we'll put aside the miasms at the moment because, I mean, we do kingdoms, miasms, and families, but the value to me is that it really brings the substances to life. And so I understand them in such a different way than I did before, whether it's a mineral or whether it's a plant or whether an animal. And so, and to really take the direct words of the patient to, in other words, I'll give you an example of an adult, because this is such a blatant example. I got this call at home from a patient of mine who had sinusitis, and he said, I'm blooming a sinus infection. And he said, it's propagating in my sinuses. And he said this. He said, it's almost floral. You know, really, how can you not think that that has something to do with what that person needs? And we have, with the animal remedies, you know, I have a kid who the only remedies ever needed is lion's milk, you know, lacleonidum. And the first sound that came out of his mouth when he was born was a roar. And he doesn't know what remedy he's on. And he says things, his mom reports to me, because I'm giving her remedy too, and he says things like, I'm at the top of the food chain, without having any idea what remedy he needs. And
which is exactly what we heard from another case of lacleonidum from Sunil.
Right. Or he said one time in between appointments, I'm nursing my wounds. So, I mean, to me, once I really learned to start listening, and it's not to say that you can't go back to the provings and, you know, and when there are provings, and which there are most of the time, and look at what the provers said. And so I think, to me, all of this has brought homeopathy to life in a way that it wasn't for me before. I think that kind of sums it up.
Could you just briefly, just for people who maybe not be familiar with this approach to selecting remedy, could you just kind of give a quick rundown on maybe the primary differences between animal, plant, and mineral so people can get a sense of what you're talking about?
Yeah, people who need homeopathic remedies made from the mineral kingdom tend to be very concerned with structure, with performance, and with loss or gain, with roles in their life, with safety and security, responsibility, all of those kinds of things. People who need animal remedies will talk about territoriality and about being kind of on the top or on the bottom,
attractiveness, sexuality.
Right, and you know, just, and also about victim aggressor. If you really listen to them, they will talk about themselves as victims and as being aggressed upon, or on the other hand, they may be the aggressors. And people who need plants tend to be much more changeable, much more sensitive, like a lot of the sensory issues Bob was referring to. And because they're changeable and more sensitive, they often have more modalities, and they may have more sensations, although, you know, there's the way Rajan categorized them, he boiled down each plant family to one main primary sensation. But so they're very different in how they present, and if you're very lucky, someone will talk about, as my patient did, about propagating and blooming. Mm. But the terminology that they'll use, if you really listen, someone who needs an animal remedy, will talk about human. They'll use the word human as if it's other than themselves. And so it's not anything at all that you push onto the case. To the contrary, you know, you just try to be like an open book, you know, an open slate or a mirror, and just let somebody talk and talk and talk, and these expressions will just begin to reveal themselves.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we find is that the chief complaint of the person often holds the key to the case if you keep probing it until you see the connection between body and mind.
It's a great entry point.
Right, and the common sensation that often shows up in both the chief complaint and the mental state.
Mm-hmm. Could you just elaborate a little bit about this idea with regard to, you said that each family within the plants will have a particular sensation? Could you?
Yeah. I mean, one of the most graphic examples of this is the compositae.
Mm-hmm.
And almost all the compositae, which includes arnica and chamomilla.
I think there's 23,000.
Well, yeah, but I'm just talking about the common ones.
We don't have that many in our Materia Medica yet. But
No.
No, not nearly. But
yeah.
They all talk about injury in some way. And so I had a case yesterday in which a new case... in which the main issue of the case, which was an ADHD case otherwise, but it was that whenever this girl would become injured, she would say, "Don't touch me," and you couldn't console her. She would push you away. Like most kids, if they get an owie, they're going to want to be picked up and held and consoled, and she just would not. And there were many things in the case, including what she said herself about hurting and getting hurt, that pointed to injury as the theme that ran through the whole case. And so I gave her arnica, not a common thing to give for ADHD.
Sure. And is that a recent case? Have you got the results
on
it?
No, I don't. Unfortunately, that was a new case yesterday that just came.
Well, we'll have to have you back on.
But it was unusual. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting case. We'll have to have you back on so you can share the results of that. We'd all be very interested to find out how that went.
Well, I remember that case that you had of the person who felt like she would be bruised when she jumped from lily pad to lily pad or something.
Oh, right. And she used to dream about car accidents.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
So
that was
accidents
an arnica case
and injury.
As well?
That was an arnica case as
very
well.
Very interesting. Could you guys maybe just share just really quickly a couple of interesting cases that you might have with regards to Asperger syndrome or autism? I mean, I think that's always of great interest to people to hear about your own clinical experience.
Yeah, I'll share one case because there's two cases in the book that are very similar, and I'm really going to summarize it because are we going to be doing questions too?
Yeah, we are. I'm going to open it up in just a few moments.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this, because I think this is not an unusual remedy. Maybe I can do not an unusual one and you can do an unusual one. We're kind of like the... I call myself sometimes the queen of the unusual remedies. But I'm going to... Boy, we live on the water, and I see an eagle flying right outside.
Oh, that's nice.
Really amazing.
Very auspicious.
Very auspicious.
We had whales this morning.
Yeah, we did. So we have a couple of cases of math savants. And so this was a case where the child, when he was just 2.5 years old, he had a real special interest in aircraft. And his father had been in the military. And they would take him to air shows, and he would go up and down the rows and identify all of the aircraft, and he would correct even the pilots that were there. And he was a math savant. So when he was in my office, he talked about how he could do square roots, cube roots, fractions, and pi in his head. And he told me what the cube root, he started with 27, and then he did the cube root of 2,197, which was 13, and he could get the problem in his brain in seconds. But he said he may not know how to explain it. And then he told me 19,683 is the answer to 27 cubed. And I got out my calculator because I wanted to check whether he was putting me on or not. But, you know, they were all right. And but on the other hand, he had had to repeat kindergarten, and he, you know, his mom said that he knows all these facts, but you can't even he doesn't even know what an ironing board is. And he was a very polite child, and so because of some of his characteristics, and because Bob had a similar case of a math savant, he needed silica.
Mm.
And, you know, very common homeopathic remedy. And he has done incredibly. I've treated him, it's over 2 years, it may even be 3 years now. And not only is he more appropriate with other kids, he his interest in math is much more appropriate. In other words, it's not an overriding kind of thing. And he actually went to camp, and he dived in to save another child who was in the water, drowning, which you might not think of for a silica kind of kid. And he got a medal, you know, some kind of a prize for that. And he even got to throw a ball at a Mariners game.
Judith, is his talent for mathematics still there? Did he lose
his
that?
His talent for math is still there.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of reviewing this case in the book. And his IQ, I know this sounds impossible, but you know how things sound impossible with homeopathy. His mom's a special ed teacher, so this is the truth. His IQ had gone up 20 points.
Wow.
From the previous time he'd been tested, he was accepted into a gifted program. So he still is very intelligent and still has facility with math, but he's not, you know, it's not to an inappropriate degree.
Interesting.
And one other thing I want to say about this kid, his teacher said that in his 25-plus years of classroom experience, he had never seen a child make so much progress in 1 year.
Wow, yeah. It's always amazing, isn't it?
It is always amazing.
It's really amazing.
Maybe Bob,
did you want to share one with
us case
before we open it up to the general audience?
Oh, that'd be fine. We can.
Do you want a short case, or do you want to open it up to the general audience?
No, I can do a short case. That's
you want to do
fine.
A short case? Okay.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite kids that I treated, who at the time I first treated him, I actually thought he had ADHD, but I realized as we went on that he really did have Asperger syndrome, as I learned more about what Asperger syndrome was. And so this was a very bright, lovable, he had bright red hair, 7-year-old. And he did have some ADHD characteristics, like he daydreamed in school and had trouble focusing and staying on task. But really the biggest thing he had was social problems. And he just never fit in with other kids at all. And partly it was because he was so intelligent. He had an IQ of 122, although his performance IQ was only 91. And that's typical, actually, of kids with AS. They often do much better on verbal scores than performance scores. And he had a very high sense of self-criticism. And whenever he made a mistake, he always felt that he was deeply disappointing his parents. And he got very upset if his report card was less than perfect. Now, one of the things that was unusual about him is he had a special interest in drawing, and he was an amazing artist. He would draw up to 50 pictures a day, and he would focus on certain things that he would draw, and he would only draw dinosaurs or only draw wildcats, and he was an amazingly good artist. But he just couldn't get social cues whatsoever, and he tended to be really pedantic, as you would see. So, now, because of his perfectionism and his real fear of making a mistake, I gave him carcinosin. And he did really, really well. Often carcinosin kids have a really strong desire to be perfect. And anytime they're less than perfect or make a mistake, it's really hard on them. So, anyway, he did incredibly well. And he began to make friends. His health improved quite a bit, and his attention became much better. And so I've treated him now for quite a long time. His habits like bedwetting and nail biting also went away. So lots of good things happened after the remedy.
And I just want to say, for those...
perfectionism got much better.
For those homeopaths out there, we happen to have presented two reasonably common remedies, but, you know, in the book Drug-Free Asperger, there's cases of... I have a panther case, a falcon, a really, really wonderful falcon case, a lot of more unusual remedies as well.
Very interesting. Well, I think it's, I mean, I have a million more questions to ask you guys, but I'm going to give other people an opportunity. Before I do that, though, let me first of all, again, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us this evening for this interview. And also let me mention, for those of you who joined us late, that we're interviewing this evening Judith Reichenberg and Robert Ullman. They are naturopathic doctors and certified in homeopathy. They've been practicing for over 20 years. They're the author of 8 excellent works in homeopathy and also other books as well, one on spirituality. They will be teaching at the NCH Annual Conference this April 8th and 9th in San Jose, California. And they'll also be offering a seminar on children, the treatment of children with Asperger syndrome in Boulder, Colorado on May 13th and 14th. And we'll be presenting this year on Memorial Day weekend at Autism One Conference in Chicago. If you want to get more information on any of these events, you can visit their website at www.drug, D-R-U-G, the word free, F-R-E-E, Asperger, Asperger.com, or you can contact them by phone at 425-774-5599. That's 425-774-5599. For those of you who have joined us on the call this evening and you're interested in acquiring any of their books, you can get a 20% discount on two or more titles by going to the Whole Health Now website, which is W-H-O-L-E, health, H-E-A-L-T-H, now, now.com/books. And if you order any of their two or more of their titles and you just type in under the comments that you were on this call, you will get a 20% discount. You can also call their toll-free number at 866-599-5950. That's 866-599-5950 and mention that you were on the call this evening and you will get that 20% discount. Bob and Judith, thank you so much. Let me open it up to the general audience, and I'll let them ask questions of you directly. 1 second. Any questions for Judith and Robert?
I have a question. Oh.
Go ahead.
What percentage of your cases would you say are due to vaccination damage?
You know, we couldn't give you a percentage, but we think it's a serious concern, and we think there's a definite correlation in a lot of cases. And, you know, for those people who aren't convinced of that, there's a really wonderful, pretty new book called Evidence of Harm. So couldn't give a percentage, but we're very, very concerned about that. And one thing at the end of Evidence of Harm, it talked about how the mercury-containing vaccines were now being shipped off to China, and China, which previously had almost no autism, is now beginning to have growing numbers of autistic kids.
Hello?
Yes,
hello.
Go ahead.
Hello, I've got a question.
Go ahead.
Do you have any other comments on the causes of what seems to be an epidemic of autism spectrum disorders?
Not really. Beyond vaccine damage, some people...
I mean, there's a number of different
causes. I mean, there are genetic factors. There are perhaps other environmental exposures. There are children who have digestive problems from an early age with perhaps a severe leaky gut kind of syndrome.
I have one kid who is very clear that it's from antibiotics. You know, the Rogam also contains mercury, and so, you know, I have a patient who that seems to be the cause. So
And some kids seem to regress into autism for no apparent reason, you know, with no obvious vaccine damage or no obvious antecedent.
Brain infections. I mean, there are a number of causes. It's not just one cause.
Other questions?
Hi.
Can I? Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, somebody new, and then if we have time, you can go back and ask the second question. Somebody else?
Yeah, it's Lee. I'm calling from Toronto.
Hi, Lee.
Hi. Do you give nutritional advice and diet changes to your kids?
Well, if you're talking about these children, I would say the great majority of these kids are already on something like a CFGF diet. And every once in a while, you know, we will make that kind of recommendation. I think in general, the idea of homeopathy is to free kids from limitations and restrictions. But I've had kids who have done well. I have one child who's in the book, and his remedy is zincum iodatum. He's done fantastically, and he had PDD. And but the encopresis, everything was getting better except for the encopresis. And so I did recommend a GFCF diet for that child. So it all depends. I think we're more likely to encourage dietary interventions with these kids than we do with our regular population of kids.
So Judith, that zincum iodatum case, was that a pretty high energy case?
He was really high energy. He looked like a little old man, and he had, you know, kind of jerky kinds of movements. And it was the perseveration that led me to keep asking his mom the same question over and over again. So I changed him from zincum to zincum iodatum. And he's a kid who has been on 1M plus. I can't remember, honestly, if it's once a week or once a month, but it's been about 3 years, and he has made incredible progress.
Great. I think we have time for one more question, so I'm going to unmute the line, and let's make one more good question, and then we'll give Judith and Bob their evening to enjoy themselves. Hold on 1 second.
Hello?
Jim?
Yes, can I add something?
Just go ahead, add something, and then go ahead.
Okay, this is Barbara at the homeopathy school in Boulder.
Oh, hey, Barbara. So
hi,
I
just wanted to say, if people want to call directly about the seminar, the telephone number is 303-440-3717, and the seminar is in May.
Can you repeat that again?
The telephone number is 303-440-3717, and the seminar is on the second weekend in May.
Great. Do we have one more question that somebody wants?
I have a question.
I think there's two here.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I have a question as far as treatment. For the parents that are under such strain as far as energy and financial, and they're trying to do so much for their child and they have feelings of guilt, do you have a policy about treating the parents as well as the children? No, we don't have any policy. This was the first book that we actually included a chapter in the book about treating the family. And so I have a case of a mom and I have a case of a sibling. No, I don't know. I don't know if anybody has a policy. I don't know that you can force someone to do that. But certainly the more members of a family that can be treated, the better. And these parents are incredibly stressed. I really agree.
Very, very excellent. Well, Bob and Judith, I want to personally thank you for a very informative, wonderful, entertaining, and educational call. I'm going to unmute the lines and let everybody give you a personal thank you, but I want to thank you personally first. So thank you so much for taking your time out for doing this, and let me open it up to the general audience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is it possible to ask one quick question?
What?
Is it possible to ask one question?
Sure, go for it.
Okay.
Go ahead. Thank you. I was wondering if you've come across many cases where you found that homeopathy just wasn't the solution.
Oh, of course.
And how often might that happen?
Oh, I don't know how often it happens, and it's hard to say whether it's that we just haven't found the right remedy, you know? I don't know how often, but certainly.
Okay.
Now, we've never said that homeopathy or we could help everybody.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Have a nice evening, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.